This is Guns and Butter. Something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Joseph Calhoun on the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center and an update from Lynn Stewart on her trial. Joseph Calhoun has been a researcher and broadcast journalist since 1979. His presentation, The 1993 World Trade Center Bombing, was part of Phase 2 of the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 in Toronto in May of 2004. Following the bombing of the World Trade Center on February 23, 1993, America's War on Terror began. Arab and Muslim terrorism became the new threat to feed the FBI, CIA, and Pentagon budget.
In the Panama deception, I did a 45-page research report, which Barbara Trent used in the Panama deception. I'd like to read a quote here that was delivered at the United Nations in 1988 by then-acting president of Panama, Manuel Solis Palma. We find it utterly unacceptable that a foreign power should use all the resources of disinformation and manipulation of people's minds in order to penetrate those sectors and force them to act against the interests of our nation. Referring to U.S. President John Quincy Adams, President Solis Palma said, "One of the most distinguished founders of the United States uttered a prophetic warning against the danger of its government going beyond its frontiers, seeking monsters to destroy. The United States government now resorts to the invention of monsters in pursuit of its designs of continental domination." He was talking about the demonization of General Noriega, specifically. And Noriega was very well demonized. In fact, the person who was given the job of demonizing Noriega in the press was a person by the name of Seymour Hersh. Hersh had two grand expose articles in 1986, in June 1986, that talked about Noriega being a drug trafficker, murderer, dictator, etc., etc. And he quoted his intelligence sources. Of course, Seymour Hersh always has intelligence sources. But it slipped out in the New York Times in one paragraph that he quoted one of his intelligence sources. And that happened to be John Poindexter, a man who currently works for the White House now and is a convicted felon for lying to Congress. So that's the extent of our investigative journalism in the corporate press in America. And it's kind of interesting why he's been given this story about the prison torture. But I'll give you just a few facts about Noriega and then go on to the main topic. Fact one is that in 1983, Noriega convened the foreign ministers of Panama, Venezuela, Mexico, and Colombia on a Panamanian island called Contadora, and he formed the Contadora Group of Nations. Not many people know that. Noriega was a graduate of the School of Americas, but one of his first deeds that he did once land was ceded back to Panama, was he closed the School of Americas in Panama. That's why it's in the United States now. Not many people know that either. So thank you, General Noriega. Anyway, in 1991, the Soviet Union collapses. All our military budget, all our CIA money was going to defeat communism. But the boogeyman is gone. So, during the campaign in 1992 in the United States, there was a talk of a peace dividend. We were going to have billions of dollars to go toward education, infrastructure, roads, free education, free health care, because we no longer needed this large Pentagon and CIA budget. And Bill Clinton campaigned, in part, on the peace dividend. Well, Bill Clinton gets elected. And the threat to the CIA and military budgets is pretty obvious. especially to career diplomats and also the industrial complex that supports the military and intelligence budgets. And if there is no longer an outside threat to the country, then there is a need to invent one. Clinton gets inaugurated in January 1993. 1 month later, a little more than 1 month later, on February 26, 1993, there was a wake-up call. The World Trade Center was bombed. All of a sudden, we need a CIA. We need a huge military budget because there's a new boogeyman for the military-industrial complex. So I thought it was kind of strange. And I'm a cynic, too much of a cynic, actually, because I usually think nothing can be done about this, or I have for a long time. And so, all of a sudden, the peace dividend disappears. It's gone. We need to fight international terrorism. And to give a perspective of when I first heard about terrorism or someone bombing something, it was around 1969 when I was a student at the University of Nebraska. And there was a bus of hippies going through Lincoln, and they were all arrested. And news went around the world that a group of hippie terrorists were in Lincoln and they were planning to blow up the state capital of Nebraska. Well, it was big news for a few days. 2 weeks later, after the story broke out, I was in the student union, and the leader of the terrorist hippie group was at a table drinking coffee. So I went to one of my friends and I said, "Well, what's going on? Why is he here?" And the guy told me, well, it was pretty obvious that the only person talking about bombing the state capitol was the FBI informant that was planted on the group. And charges were dropped. And the story died. You never heard of it. So that's the first time I ever heard about FBI entrapment. Before coming here, I almost forgot my passport. I fortunately had it and got on the plane and I managed to get here. But in 1973 was the first time I registered for a U.S. passport. And I don't know if they still do it now, but they did it then. You had to raise your right hand and swear to protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I thought it was a bit of a joke. But after I dug out my passport coming here, it's no longer a joke, because the domestic enemies of the Constitution of the United States far eclipse their invented terrorists, or the foreign enemies. The masters and the mentors of terrorism that exist in Washington, D.C. and in the CIA are no match for their apprentices and proteges that they invent. And so I'm taking defending and protecting the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, very seriously now. And that's why I'm here at this conference. Anyway, FBI has been involved in entrapment on a number of things, drug cases, abscam. But there are field agents who actually do their job. When the World Trade Center was bombed in 1993, I think it was Senator Lugar got on CNN, and he said, made a statement, "We don't have any proof, but we know it's Iran that did it." Well, fortunately, the entire van didn't blow up into unrecognizable pieces. An FBI agent who actually did his job found the axle, and there was a serial number on that axle. And when they traced the serial number, it was to a Ryder rental van agency in New Jersey. So the first arrested in the World Trade Center bombing was one of the bombers who was trying to get his deposit back for the van. And I thought, this story is very suspicious. If I had rented the van that blew up the World Trade Center, I wouldn't be in the country, let alone try to get my deposit back on it. So I kind of kept my ear to the ground on this story. Other arrests were made, and the group that they arrested centered around a certain blind Islamic cleric in New Jersey, in a New Jersey mosque. The blind Islamic cleric was named Sheikh Abdul Rahman. And no arrest was made on Sheikh Abdul Rahman for 3 months. Janet Reno made a statement saying there's not enough evidence to arrest him. Well, I happened to be on the Internet at the time, and I had certain stories put in my file on this Internet service, mostly involving the CIA and Iran-Contra. But a dispatch from AP came in from Egypt, and I thought, well, what's that doing there? And it was an AP dispatch which said, the blind cleric involved in the World Trade Center bombing in New York City is a paid CIA agent, according to President Hosni Mubarak in a government newspaper. And the story went on. In fact, Sheikh Abdul Rahman was wanted in Egypt for trying to assassinate Hosni Mubarak at the time. And so I thought, my God, this story is going to break wide open. It's going to break wide open. It was an Associated Press dispatch. It wasn't Pacifica News. It wasn't, you know, something else. It was Associated Press. It never made the light of day in any newspaper in the country. But within 24 hours after that broke, Sheikh Abdul Rahman was arrested for immigration violations. And a month later or so, he was actually indicted for sedition. So I kept my ear to the ground real carefully on this story and was looking for anything I could get pertaining to this story about him being a paid CIA agent. Well, about 6 weeks later, we have an independent PBS station out in Denver. I live in Colorado now. And they had ITN News from Britain on. And they had a special report on the bombing of the World Trade Center. And in that report, it said that all of the bombers of the World Trade Center in 1993 had been on the CIA payroll. They had been on the CIA payroll in Afghanistan. All of them. Later, about a week or so later, ABC News had a special. It was their day one news magazine with Forrest Sawyer and John Hockenberry. And they said the same thing. And so I thought this story was going to break again. And there were lame excuses from the FBI and the CIA. The FBI said, the CIA at the time, it was mostly focused on the CIA. The CIA said, well, gee, we didn't know these people we were funding in Afghanistan were going to come over here and blow up the World Trade Center. You know, that was the end of the story. No one asked a follow-up. And so it was no more news. No scandal, no investigation, and a story. But the story did get better, because during the trial of the defendants in 1995, it was revealed that the one person who probably wasn't a paid CIA agent, or at least who wasn't paid to go to Afghanistan, was an Egyptian by the name of Imad Salim. He was the FBI informant. And not only was it revealed that he infiltrated the group, but he also organized the group. He made the bomb that went off at the World Trade Center. And I think there was one report that I've seen that he actually drove the van in the World Trade Center, but I have to check up on that. But I want to read a few quotes from Newsday about that story in the New York Times. This is from Newsday, December 15, 1993. Defense attorneys William Kunstler and Ron Kuby maintained the entire plot had been contrived and led by the very FBI informant whose testimony was used to secure the convictions. Kunstler and Kuby contended in a letter to U.S. District Judge Michael Mukasey that Imad Salim, the chief informant in the case, was responsible for the World Trade Center bombing. Information Salim said in a taped conversation with FBI agent Ancliffe, quote, we start already building the bomb, which is went off in the World Trade Center. It was built, supervision from the Bureau and the DA, and we all were all informed about it. And we know that the bomb was starting to be built. By who? By your confidential informant. What a wonderful, great case. That was Newsday, December 15th, 1993. The tapes also reveal that the FBI knew in advance of the bomb plot and planned to thwart it by substituting a harmless powder for explosives. But the substitution was called off at the last moment. At one point, informant Salim, a 43-year-old former Egyptian army officer, recalls that the FBI had planned on building the bomb with a phony powder and grabbing the people who were involved in it. But Salim, who is heard lecturing his FBI handlers, said the powder scheme was called off and we didn't do that. Salim was also heard on the tapes criticizing the agents for ignoring his warnings that the World Trade Center was to be bombed. Guys, quote, guys, you know, you saw this bomb went off, and you both know that we could avoid that, he says. And that was from the New York Times, October 28, 1993. That was a very explosive news item at the time. But no one gave it much attention because they were tried in 1995. And there was a convenient diversion for everybody. There was also someone else tried in 1995 by the name of O.J. Simpson. And that's where all your, quote, investigative journalists, that's all they were watching. Anyway, the defendants were convicted. They were given life terms. And Emad Salim, the FBI informant, was given $1 million for his testimony. And the only reason I think he got $1 million for his testimony, because he insisted on himself being wired, because he wanted to record the conversations with the people he was provoking, the people he was infiltrating. Unbeknownst to the FBI, he was also recording them. And so it was kind of a revolt of the patsy. He didn't go to jail with the rest of them. So anyway, when 9-1-1 happened, the first thought on my mind was the World Trade Center bombing in 1993. And of course, I thought this was too well orchestrated to have happened by just a group of terrorists. And I remember the two news programs about the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. And I was in New York City 18 days after 9-1-1. And I contacted ABC News Archive to see if they could search for this 1993 program they did on the CIA connection to the World Trade Center bombings. And the secretary found it, and she said, oh, here it is, July 12, 1993. Would you like a video copy or a transcript? And I said, well, I'd like both. And she starts writing out the order. And she says, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. A copy of this program is no longer for sale and no longer available. Well, I tried to find out why. And I kept getting another number to call. And finally, after about three times, they referred me to their legal department, which was actually a voice recording. I was told on this voice recording that I would have to give them the serial number of the program I requested. I would have to tell why I wanted it and what I was going to do with it. And if they couldn't help me, that it would take a court subpoena for me to get that program. And so I thought that was very interesting. But I have a copy of the program anyway, because I recorded it on the day of broadcast, 1993. And you're going to see that shortly. But I have to say that FBI agents do their job. The story about 9-1-1, I'd say the true story about 9-1-1, almost broke when in June 2002, Colleen Rowley in Minnesota made public her memo to FBI Director Mueller about her concerns in the Moussaoui case, because Colleen Rowley knew everything about Zacharias Moussaoui, how he was going to flight school, how he wanted to be trained to know how to fly a plane but not land it. And she was making desperate reports to the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. And the FBI just basically told her to don't worry about it. It's not going to happen. And she was absolutely dumbfounded. And the story broke in June about the memo in Time, June 3rd, 2002. The bombshell memo. And I want to quote from the memo. This is Colleen Rowley. Everyone's first question was why. Why would an FBI agent deliberately sabotage a case? I know I shouldn't be flippant about this, but jokes were made that the key FBI headquarters personnel had to be spies or moles, like Robert Hansen, who were actually working for Osama bin Laden, to have so undercut the Minneapolis effort. So once again, I thought this story was going to break wide open. And actually, it did a little bit. It was the first time George Bush was asked what he knew about 9-1-1 before it happened. And he had to deny that he knew anything about it. And so I was waiting for the press to do their investigative job and break the story wide open. But what happened? There was a little girl lost in Utah by the name of Elizabeth Smart in June 2002. And all the investigative reporters went to Salt Lake City, Utah. I was in Washington, D.C. in the latter part of June to cover a march on the FBI and the Justice Department. And I went past the White House and looked at the White House press corps tents that they have set up on the north lawn of the White House. They were completely vacant with flags waving. And so people like Colleen Rowley and FBI agents like Robert Wright, who can't talk anything about what he knows because he's being gagged, do their jobs.
You're listening to researcher and broadcast journalist Joseph Calhoun, the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. This is Guns and Butter.
I would like to get to the video. It starts out with a poem from a movie called 20 Years Ago Today by the BBC, and it's a poem about the Vietnam War, about lies.
I was run over by the truth one day. Ever since the accident, I've walked this way. So stick my legs in plaster. Tell me lies about Vietnam. Heard the alarm clock screaming with pain. Couldn't find myself, so I went back to sleep again. So fill my ears with silver. Stick my legs in plaster. Tell me lies about Vietnam. Every time I shut my eyes, all I see is flames.
Think you got any of you?
Made a marble phone book. Carved all the names. So coat my eyes with butter. Fill my ears with silver. Stick my legs in plaster. Tell me lies about Vietnam. I smell something burning. Hope it's just my brains. They're only dropping peppermints and daisy chains. So stuff my nose with garlic. Coat my eyes with butter. Fill my ears with silver. Stick my legs in plaster. Tell me lies about Vietnam. Where were you at the time of the crime? Down by the cenotaph, drinking slime. So chain my tongue with whiskey. Stuff my nose with garlic. Coat my eyes with butter. Fill my ears with silver. Stick my legs in plaster. Tell me lies about Vietnam. You put your bombers in. You put your conscience out. You take the human being and you twist it all about. So scrub my skin with women. Chain my tongue with whiskey. Stuff my nose with garlic. Fill my ears with silver. Stick my legs in plaster. Tell me lies about Vietnam.
In North America, we have a population that is well-educated and very literate. How is it that they are so easily manipulated into believing such obvious lies, and they are able to go along with those lies to do harm to populations of the world in a manner that is so against their own moral principles? Could you please explain how this is possible?
There's a both simple answer and a complex answer. The simple answer is we have a propaganda machine called television, and that all the corporate heads of the TV and newspapers have the same ideological agenda as the people who own and operate us, as the people in politics, as the military-industrial complex. I think NBC is owned by General Electric. ABC, William Casey, who was head of the CIA, had an interest in ABC, and Disney now. And now I'm trying to remember who owns CBS, Viacom. And so all these, the heads of these various groups have the same ideological agenda. There's something interesting. I didn't talk about field reporters. When I was at the Noriega trial, I attended the beginning and then the end. And everybody, was, of course, was excited at the beginning. They were going to really show the CIA connection or whatever, the Iran-Contra connection to Noriega. The whole trial there was a show trial. You had a CIA lawyer. You had a CIA lawyer there, and the first time I sat down, and when the defense attorney, Mr. Rubino, mentioned Israel or the CIA or the Iran-Contra, this short little CIA lawyer would get up, objection, 412-615, and what we discussed yesterday. And the judge would just say, sustained, usually. I was going, well, jab someone. I say, what was that? Is he objecting in code? And, yeah. So we couldn't even find out why. See, In the trial, and this is why I don't know why it's not happened in the Zachariah Moussaoui trials, it seemed like they goofed up. They were going to try Jose Fernandez, the CIA agent in Panama, in Iran-Contra. But they threw out the case because they said they'd have to reveal secrets. Well, in the case of General Noriega, they tried him anyway, but they instituted what was called the Classified Information Procedures Act. And his pro forma argument was actually censored, too. There are blank pages in it. The initial argument that the defense attorney gave for him. He couldn't give it because half the pages are blank. And so it was an entire show trial. Well, getting back to the point of why people are manipulated into believing this, when I came back, there was one reporter, I'd always get these inside stories about what was going on. And when I came back to the trial, I had to go to Miami Herald to catch up, and I found out there were no stories on the trial. And so I was wondering, was there a break? Did the judge have another heart attack or what? So I went to the trial and I asked the reporters, well, what? I didn't notice there was any information for 2 weeks. And David Lyons, I think his name was the Miami Herald reporter there that reported on the trial. The trial was starting to go in favor of General Noriega, and it was so favorable that the editor-in-chief decided to censor the articles of its own newsman there. And then all these newsmen, they didn't look as happy as they were at the beginning of the trial. And they were telling me all sorts of stuff that went on. And I said, well, why don't you guys write about this and print it? And they said, well, we do, but our editors won't print it, you know. And so I was going to do a story on the media when I got back for this little newspaper I do that is independent, called the Monte Libre Monthly in Denver. And I called this guy from the Associated Press to get a little more information. I said, I'm doing a story on the media. And this guy went into a panic attack. He says, right now I want to tell everything that I told you is off the record. Do not quote me. I would work for a very conservative news agency, and I don't want to get into trouble. And I said, oh, okay. And, you know, I said, okay, but he kept on talking. I mean, he was almost going into a nervous breakdown to find out that I was going to do a story on the media. So there are people out there, even field reporters, that want to know the news. But if it's not a good story, and I think Noam Chomsky talks about this in Manufacturing Consent, it's called cognitive dissonance. You believe the official line because you have to believe the official line, especially with the way news business has gone in the United States with CNN, etc. If they want to maintain their six-digit incomes, you better toe the line. So that's primarily the way people believe this. But I've also found with what's coming out of Iraq with the prison abuse and everything else, I'm wondering why Bush even has 40% support. It should be way down, you know, to the 33% neo-Nazi Confederate Texas hardcore. And it's because a lot of people right now find the lie easier to deal with than the truth. Because if they believe the truth, then they obviously have to do something about it. So it's better to, you know, just go to work, come home, and not think about it, and watch TV.
What do you think? Do you think there was an intention to create a deliberate enemy that they needed to maintain their military budget? Or was this just an oversight, a mistake of our bumbling CIA?
The short answer is yes. It was created for the military-industrial complex. I'll elaborate just a little bit. I think it was a speech by the late Henry Gonzalez. But he was talking about how leaders in countries south of the border of the United States, they don't deal with who's in office. They don't care who's in office because every 4 years, the presidents change. So they know who to deal with. They deal with the CIA. They deal with the FBI because those are the agencies that live and the career agents stay in there, go through presidencies all the time. J. Edgar Hoover is a perfect example. He had files on all the presidents, and that's how he stayed in power. So these agencies want to make sure they stay in power. Now, if you don't have a threat, like I said, you need to invent one. And the strange thing, and I hope someone covers this story before it slips away. In fact, I think there was some good news. It was they had a full-page article about the execution of Nicholas Burke. What I talked about was the revolt of the Patsies, or the Patsy Imad Salim. I think he was supposed to go down with the ship, but he very smartly had himself wired and also recorded his FBI handlers. So that's why he got his $1 million and left the country. It seems like the Patsies are finally finding out that they're Patsies. The best puppets you can have are the ones that don't know their strings are being pulled. In the case of the execution of Nicholas Burke, I think a lot of people were very suspicious. Timing is very good to all of a sudden forget about the torture and abuse, and in fact, forget about the other pictures that we're not seeing, that one congressman or senator said are 100 times worse than what we have already seen. And Donald Rumsfeld said if it was up to him, he'd show all of them, but because he has to protect the rights of the defendants for being court-martialed, we can't do that right now. And there's actually 26, I think, executions of Iraqis that they interrogated that we won't see. And so it was kind of convenient to show how these Arabs were much worse than us by the execution of Nicholas Berg. Well, I looked at that picture and I noticed that the executioners were not malnourished Iraqi insurgents. In fact, they looked about as big as me. And someone pointed out very quickly that Nicholas Berg was in an orange jumpsuit like they have in Guantanamo Bay. One of the pictures that recently came out in the Washington Post, they also wear those orange prison jumpsuits at Abu Ghraib prison. Someone also noticed the white chair he was sitting in. It's the same style, same color as the chair that Lindy English was sitting in when she was being hugged by the person she tortured Iraqis with. And that chair also appears the same style, same color, appears in the hallway of Abu Ghraib prison. What is funny about that is the story, the suspicion about that execution did not come from some internet blog that I looked up. The first story that came out on, of all places, CNN. The first report was that, according to CNN staff experts, the voice in the recording could not be Azakawi because it was not a Jordanian accent. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I was going to try to find out who these CNN staff experts were and ask them more questions. But while I was trying to do that, within 24 hours, there was breaking news on CNN. Breaking news was that CIA analysts have analyzed the tape and have determined absolutely 100% it is the voice of terrorist al-Zarqawi. Well, I got an email from someone in the audience, actually, fortunately, that actually had the transcript of one of the CIA staff experts. Her name is Octavia Nasser. She's a correspondent for CNN in Kuwait who monitors Arabic and television stations and broadcasts. And she was the one that said, first of all, it's not a Jordanian accent, so that rules Azakawi out. She was interviewed by Miles O'Brien on CNN. Then she said, I'm trying to go in the sequence, she said, even if it was Azakawi, it's rumored that there's several reports that he was dead, that he got hit when they attacked the Kurdish so-called Al-Qaeda cell in the Kurdish part of Iraq. And then she said, even if he's not dead, he had his right leg amputated, and there was no limp of this guy that was doing the beheading. And she said, in fact, it's kind of curious, their skin is as white as Berg's. And she said the weapons they had were an AK-47 and an Israeli counterpart to it. And her conclusion is, she said, it would be very interesting to find out who these people really are. Now, that's CNN. The evidence suggests, no proof here, that Nicholas Berg was killed at Abu Ghraib prison.
Joseph Calhoun's research about Panama and the CIA involvement in drug trafficking in the late 1980s was included in the Academy Award-winning documentary, The Panama Deception. He does documentary work with Free Speech TV in Boulder, Colorado, research for INN News of New York City, and writes for the Mont Libre Monthly of Denver, Colorado.